Welcome to Discovery, Cedars-Sinai's podcast about research and education. I'm your host, Dr. Corey Cross. Pushing the frontiers of AI in medicine means being both an evangelist and a skeptic at the same time. Just as we're beginning to grasp the devastating role bias has on healthcare outcomes, powerful AI technology has the potential to address these problems, or, if not carefully deployed, amplify them. Today, we have two wonderful guests here to discuss how to ensure that AI is used as a tool to counter bias and ensure health equity. We are joined by Dr. Melissa Wong, Assistant Professor of Maternal-Fetal Medicine in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and also by Dr. Tiffany J. Bright, Research Scientist and Co-Director for the Center for Artificial Intelligence Research and Education. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So let's jump right in. When talking about AI, one of the first questions doctors ask is, what about the Obermeyer study? And for those of us not familiar with this study, can you explain it and why it's so relevant to a discussion on AI in medicine?
Yeah, this study was really eye-opening, not just because of sort of the broad coverage it received, but also the way in which it really frames how we need to think about algorithmic bias. So this study really focused on essentially what seemed sort of a lofty goal, which is insurance companies trying to identify those patients who are at most risk and therefore really assigning them, you know, potential extra care teams. So the goal being then to, for the sickest patients to essentially get more care and more care management. The issue, though, and what they were able to identify in the Obermeyer paper was that how those resources were then distributed was not done in an equitable way. So because they labeled for essentially that, right, there's no way to exactly sort of quantify, there's no variable for sickest patient, but what they can measure relatively easily, especially on the payer side, is something like cost. So because they targeted their model for cost, what they instead found was essentially the patients who spent the most on their care, which is different, especially whenever we think about healthcare access, when we think about inequities in distribution of care and distribution of procedures or surgeries. So as a result, you ultimately essentially had to be sicker. You had to have a greater disease burden to get into the program if you were Black than if you were white.
Got it. So flash forward, what has occurred in the field of AI that gives you hope that AI will in fact increase access to healthcare without sacrificing health equity?
I think for me that hope comes from a variety of sources. We have awareness. So I think that's the starting point. Because of that critical study, we now have guidelines coming out from Obermeyer, from the American Medical Association. We have the federal government involved. Obermeyer was a sounding point, and then we have the COVID-19 pandemic. Then we have a public health system that isn't equipped to handle the inequities already happening. So you take that and you take algorithms, and what happens? You know, we saw it with the pandemic. And so there's hope for me because of that awareness. There's hope for me that there's social, we're talking about social justice. And again, when you have that awareness and then you have, oh, what's social justice? Okay, well, social justice is a cause. Says, well, let's get better data. Let's talk about how systems of inequities are embedded in our healthcare system. That leads to questions of how do we better identify the root cause? And so I think there are a lot of opportunities of hope.
Absolutely. I would agree with you. You can't address things until you know that they're occurring. So hopefully we're in that process now where we see what's occurring and also where we realize that sometimes you mean to study one thing and, you know, this happens in studies all the time, you end up getting results that are tainted because the data in was tainted and you didn't realize that as you were setting up the study. So it's always, I mean, studies and hypotheses are always a learning experience. So hopefully I agree with you. We're on that process to better learning, which will give us better results. So Dr. Wong, do you have anything to add to this regarding Obermeyer and the playbook? Could you explain that to our listeners?
I would agree with Dr. Bright that awareness is a really important step, and for so many reasons, including what she alluded to related to the pandemic, the awareness is really raised in this. And then certainly even in the last 6 months, I would say, with the broad public engagement with generative AI in the form of ChatGPT, DALL-E and others, that there's just a general awareness of, like, these things are great, but, you know, there are different people really working on this, a lot of different research groups, including Dr. Obermeyer's, including the NIH. There's initiatives called, you know, including one that's called Aim Ahead, really focused specifically on increasing perspectives and as a way to sort of counteract these biases, because I don't think we have any playbook that tells us definitively what to next do about them. So in Obermeyer's playbook, he talks about these ideas of really an algorithmic inventory. And I think this makes so much sense, right? So we don't accept that anything in medicine is completely opaque, right? We don't just sort of all start taking a medication other than maybe aspirin without really knowing in detail how it works. And we mandate that of our pharmaceutical companies. And it's really not been the case necessarily for AI or for algorithms, right? So we sort of, in the vein of HIPAA or in the vein of proprietary things, we've allowed some of this to just be a little bit more black box than we might, for example, for a medication. And then these ideas, I think the other parts he talks about in it are really these ideas of measuring the bias themselves. So we all know that there's going to be bias built in, right? Any model needs to have bias for it to be meaningful, mathematically meaningful. A model that has no bias is a coin flip. So how do we measure, though, the bias that we want and then measure the bias that we don't want? So whether it's by stratification of outcomes, whether it's by actually training different models for different purposes, there's sort of a lot of work to be done on then going in and rooting out, okay, there's bias that we want, but how do we actually eliminate the kind that we don't want, especially in these prescriptive algorithms going forward? And then the idea of actually doing something about it, which I think is the big next break.
Those are great points that Dr. Wong raised, the transparency, especially when we're moving these algorithms into healthcare, the idea that companies can stand behind the wall of it's proprietary is just insufficient when we're trying to build trust. And in working in industry where these models were proprietary and then being transferred into the clinical setting really created an issue, because if these algorithms, when they're so complex and developers can't understand them, they don't present as good candidates in the clinical environment. I was reading an article about it. I think it was in Stat Plus recently, Melissa. I don't know if you saw it, about Medicare Advantage. There was some, you know, ruffling of feathers about how, trying to explain how that algorithm denies care or approves care. When we have that, it erodes trust for the providers, for the patients. And so really addressing that black box problem is something that we have to do. And as we address that, to Melissa's point, we can also start to adjust what are the levels of bias that are acceptable. And that comes down to thinking about what type of metrics are we going to use when we're talking about mitigating bias, because there are different types of methods that you want. And some bias you have to accept and some you don't. But that's why it's important that we are creating models that are measurable and transparent. It's just, it all relates together.
So how does the role of data and the data that you use play into all of this? How are you creating AI tools in this model?
There are a lot of considerations, especially when it comes specifically to the data issue. So, and there's actually some guidance on this. I think it might have even been, I'm thinking of, there's a Parikh article published in JAMA from a couple of years ago that went through some of these ways to actually counteract the bias. So the data that we put in absolutely drives ultimately the data that'll come out. So they sort of reference these ideas around statistical bias, i.e., when the algorithm or when the data set wasn't derived from people like you or like the patient sitting in front of you, then it's not going to work as well for the patient sitting in front of you. And sort of the classic example that we now know of this is the Framingham cohort for predicting adverse cardiac outcomes. So we know that as a result, it does really well for middle to older age Caucasian or white people and less well for really everybody else. So that's sort of the statistical bias principle. The more kind of worrisome one, or kind of gross one, quite frankly, is something what they categorize as what's called social bias, or the idea that essentially all of these things that we talk about, these social determinants of health, ultimately then impact the care provided and might do so in a biased way. And then there's sort of the double whammy of having both. So let's say of statistical and social. So let's say poorer patients, for example, have less access to care. And so they're more adverse outcomes because of the social biases that aren't reflected in the model, period, because they're also then not included in it.
That makes sense. So Dr. Wong, you have been studying, I believe, disparities in childbirth outcomes and C-sections. Could you tell us a little bit about the study that you're doing regarding C-sections and helping physicians?
So we are essentially using a machine learning model to try to predict which patients are likely to require a cesarean delivery. What we're able to do differently by using machine learning is a lot of models have really only taken your sort of walk in the door information. And with our model, we're actually able to continuously generate predictions about every 10 minutes for somebody in labor. And at this point, we have the model running in the background. We're actually comparing the predictions of the model to doctors to sort of, you know, doc versus machine, see who is better at predicting the direction a patient is going to go. But our eventual goal is to actually integrate it as clinical decision support, sort of in real time, for clinicians, for physicians and nurses, but also even for patients to be able to better understand their likelihood in an ongoing fashion and all of the factors that come into this. The disparities exist, quite frankly. You know, we've known about them for decades. So not only your racial disparities, sort of honing in on that one, then in terms of your probability of ultimately having a cesarean delivery, but then also even in terms of the reasons for cesarean delivery. So even whenever you control for sort of all of the factors that should biologically, quote unquote, explain this, we still see that there are differences even at the race level for, you know, the reasons. So that the sort of more objective ones, for example, things like the baby being breech, which is pretty much straight to if baby's still breech by the time you're in labor, or if the placenta is in the way, for example, all of those are pretty equitably or equally, I should say, distributed among populations. But some of the more subjective ones, for example, you know, a worrisome looking heart rate tracing or even people arresting how much they dilate in labor, those disproportionately fall on Black patients. So we've known that there's been bias. In fact, one of our more recent sort of highlights of this was actually the VBAC calculator as another indication that it's a calculator that we use to help patients counsel their probability of having a cesarean delivery. And there were little dropdowns for it. And one of those dropdowns was actually Black, yes or no, Hispanic, yes or no. And if you were marked as being Black, then it actually dropped the predicted probability because it was based on historical data. And since the historical data said you were more likely to get a C-section if you were Black, then now the prescriptive data said that you should be more likely to get a C-section if you were Black. So it's sort of a really, you know, case study in sort of what can happen when these biases of the past become then the predictions of the future.
That's a really good point. Like, it just really shows that if you're taking one set of data and you're not realizing why you have that data, but thinking about it from a different point of view, you know, you're not saying this is already skewed and you're putting it in as if it's not, what you're getting out is going to be skewed.
Exactly. And usually, you know, the nice thing, if one can say this about something like the VBAC calculator, is that, you know, at the end of the day, I did have to pick that little dropdown. So a lot of us out in the field actually counseling patients just wouldn't pick the dropdown because it just seemed a little icky. Even in the Obermeyer paper that we started talking about, that's actually what they saw as well, that docs were disproportionately enrolling their Black patients because they could see past the algorithm and say, yeah, but this person actually does need help. That's what we sort of see in, you know, even the way that we handle the VBAC calculator in OB is that as long as we're able to see the guts of it, in the VBAC calculator, we could literally just ignore that dropdown. What makes it all more worrisome is whenever we lose that transparency and you're just handed the prediction itself without any ability to, you know, really tweak the knobs, if you will, for what got you that prescription.
Thank you for that answer. And to sort of sum it up, Dr. Bright, if maybe you'll start off, where do you see us in 5 or 10 years? How do you see AI playing a role in healthcare?
I think it'll be one of the clinicians' most prominently used tool. I think it's going to be some type of generative AI, right? It'll be used to summarize. It's going to be a wonderful tool to hopefully reduce the burden of documentation on clinicians. That's one way I see AI, by being more integrated in electronic health records. So that's a positive. I see it as raising the equity bar by earlier identification of patients for clinical trials. I really see it as something that is going to move healthcare forward. I see it as something that's going to be used for our good. I do, with the cautionary tale that we address the root causes of bias. But it's asking, just because we have the data, do we need an AI system? Those are some of the questions that I start to ask nowadays. Like, just because you can do something with data doesn't mean an AI solution is necessary. So those are the types of questions that I'd like more developers, more clinicians, more of us to have that conversation at the beginning. So I see making sure that we have the diverse teams, because AI can do, again, all these wonderful things in healthcare, and it's with that asterisk. So like, is there the right solution for it? Who's it serving? Do we have the right team? I think those are all the things that I would say are required for it to do all the things that it's promised to change healthcare.
I would agree with you. As a pediatrician, I feel like I would be able to use AI as a tool, but not as a replacement. I just don't think that you can lean on it to make decisions, but maybe right now we're at a time where we're doing so much research so quickly, and it's hard to stay on top of everything. I can see AI being able to be abreast of all of the studies that are going on and really bring that information to the doctor so that they can make a good decision, but transparently.
Yeah, it's to Melissa's point, Obermeyer's like, you know, we talk about bias, but what are the actual bias mitigation strategies? It's like, we have to get all that right, and then it's going to be a fascinating tool, and it's going to hopefully return the humanness to medical care. So I have a lot of hope.
I love that. And Dr. Wong, do you have anything to add?
No, I completely agree. I oftentimes say that I feel like the North Star for when we decide what AI to incorporate into care is really the idea of recreating or bringing us back to that actual patient-physician relationship and the ways that we can be, you know, cognitively creative in ways that AI can't, right? So I've heard it described as AI is really good at getting you the answers, but the humans are really necessary for figuring out the right questions. And so I completely agree. If there's one thing that I always say is really important as clinicians, because that's often a question that comes up, is, you know, what do I really need to know about AI? I think that we all just need to stay incredibly like invested and aware and engaged with this work, because just because something can be measured doesn't mean it actually matters. And I think that unless we do stay engaged in it, we are going to be subject to whatever whims, you know, whatever can increase your bottom line and that sort of thing, rather than what really matters directly for our patients. And just to highlight, you know, Dr. Bright's point as well, like I couldn't agree more. And as you were saying, Dr. Cross, that we need help as clinicians. There is so much coming in from everywhere, whether it's things like patient data, whether they're coming in with their own wearable data, you know, or I think that I heard that the doubling rate of the medical literature back in the 50s was on the order of decades, and now is something like a couple of months. So it is just physically impossible, cognitively impossible to expect that of any clinician, any doctor. So to the degree that any of these things can help rein that in, you know, give you some guidance around what might be a little off in your care, what might be a little bit better for your patient, I don't think any of us have too much hubris to accept something like that.
I would agree. Thank you, Dr. Wong and Dr. Bright, for your time today. This has been a fascinating discussion. You can visit cedars-sinai.org/discoveries to read more about artificial intelligence in medicine and all the stories in Cedars-Sinai's magazine about research and education. That's cedars-sinai.org/discoveries. That concludes this episode of Discoveries, Cedars-Sinai's podcast about research and education. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it on your social channels and be sure to check out the entire podcast library for other topics that might be of interest to you. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Thanks for listening to this episode of Discoveries. I'm your host, Dr. Corey Cross.